Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 25th of August, 2009, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 4 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week, we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. Now, having said that, today's format is actually going to be slightly different. After our LGBT news roundup, we're going to have a world exclusive here on Reality Check. Yes, we're going to hear an interview with John Davey and John Kloprog, the two activists who created national headlines with their silent protest at the National Marriage Breakfast in Canberra a couple of weeks ago. Then, in our movie review section, we'll review the newly released documentary, The Cove. So stay tuned for that and more here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. But right now, let's get our first segment underway, the LGBT News Roundup for this week. Okay, here's your LGBT news for the last 7 days or so. First up, let's go to Senegal in West Africa. The International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, otherwise known as IGLHRC, along with a South African Muslim NGO called the Inner Circle, issued a press release last week expressing their outrage at reports that a 17-year-old Senegalese man would stand trial on August 24th, so that was actually yesterday, stand trial for sexual acts against nature, and that two other men were convicted on identical charges during the week of August 10th, 2009. The three men, all from the town of Daru Musti in Louga, Senegal, were arrested and detained for alleged same-sex relations on June 19th, 2009, together with a fourth man whose status is currently unknown. The first two men were sentenced to 2 and 5 years in prison, respectively. Reports indicate that denunciations from neighbours were the only evidence against the men. These are unfortunately just the latest in a pattern of arbitrary arrests and detentions based on perceived sexual orientation in Senegal, a country in which same-sex relations are illegal. Homophobia is widespread and incitement to violence against those perceived to be lesbian, gay, bisexual or transgender is often encouraged by politicians and religious leaders. This is yet another indication that gay men and those perceived to be gay are in grave danger in Senegal, said IGLHRC Executive Director Kerry Allen Johnson. The arrests violate both international and African human rights law. Unpopularity is never a justification for abuse. That's another quote from Kerry Allen Johnson. Human rights abuses related to sexual orientation and gender identity in Senegal have accelerated since February 2008, when 10 people were arbitrarily arrested and charged with homosexuality, incitement to debauchery, and corruption of good behavior after popular tabloid magazine Icon published pictures of a ceremony to affirm a gay relationship. In a separate incident in August 2008, two men were arrested at their home in Dakar for homosexual marriage and also charged with acts against the order of nature. In December 2008, nine members of Aid Senegal, a local HIV prevention organization, who were participating in an education workshop to combat HIV and AIDS, were arrested and sentenced to 8 years in prison for what was called indecent conduct and unnatural acts, along with conspiracy. The Court of Appeals in Dakar fortunately overturned their conviction in April this year. There have been a number of similar cases in recent years, and the body of a gay man who died of natural causes was twice removed from a cemetery earlier this year by angry villagers. While there are occasional arrests and convictions of gay men in Senegal, social stigma and blackmail are the most prevalent abuses faced by gay men in the country. Last year, the African Assembly for the Defense of Human Rights expressed concern over the rise of homophobia and hatred of gays in the country. So that's very unpleasant news there from Senegal. Let's hope that that 17-year-old who was tried yesterday was not actually convicted. I couldn't see information on the internet before I came on air. I think it's not even... given that we're a day ahead here in Australia, it probably hasn't happened yet, but let's hope that he will get off. All right, moving now to the UK, where we actually have a news item that combines the two main themes of this show, LGBT issues and skepticism. Well, it combines them in a way. This is an article about the late great scientist Alan Turing, who was prosecuted for homosexuality in the 1950s, a British scientist. There is now a campaign to get an official apology to Alan Turing issued by the British government, and one of the world's most famous atheists and skeptics, Richard Dawkins, has joined that fight. Alan Turing was a code-breaking genius and has been called the father of the modern computer. During the Second World War, he worked at a military establishment called Bletchley Park, where he helped to break the Nazi Enigma code. He committed suicide in 1954, 2 years after his prosecution for homosexuality. More than 2,500 people have now added their names to the online petition calling for the government to recognise the consequences of prejudice that ended the life of the scientist aged just 41. Richard Dawkins said that an apology would, and I quote, "send a signal to the world which needs to be sent," end quote. And that Turing would still be alive today if it were not for the repressive, religion-influenced laws which drove him to despair. Dawkins, who is actually due to present a forthcoming television show on Alan Turing, said that the impact of the mathematician's war work could not be overstated. Turing arguably made a greater contribution to defeating the Nazis than Eisenhower or Churchill, according to Dawkins. Thanks to Turing and his colleagues at Bletchley Park, Allied generals in the field were consistently, over long periods of the war, privy to detailed German plans before the German generals had time to implement them. Quoting Dawkins again, after the war, when Turing's role was no longer top secret, he should have been knighted and feted as a saviour of his nation. Instead, this gentle, stammering, eccentric genius was destroyed for a crime committed in private which harmed nobody, said Richard Dawkins. That was an interesting news item to me. After reading this, I did a bit of investigation myself about Alan Turing because I actually knew very little about him. The famous Turing test, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard of, was developed by him. This is a test used to determine if humans have created artificial intelligence and whether a machine can be said to think. Turing's trial for homosexuality was based on the exact same law that had been used to try Oscar Wilde more than 50 years earlier. And unfortunately, both of those stories had a tragic ending. Turing's story is actually quite reminiscent of Oscar Wilde's, in fact. Turing's trial for homosexuality ended his illustrious career, and he killed himself soon afterwards by eating an apple laced with cyanide. Some have even suggested that he was reenacting a scene from Snow White, his favorite fairy tale, supposedly. And the thing that surprised me most, though, in reading his life story was this, and that is that after being convicted of so-called gross indecency, he was given a choice between imprisonment or chemical castration. He accepted the chemical castration and was given estrogen hormone injections for a year, which were designed to reduce his libido. Doesn't that sound horrible? Chemical castration. It's amazing what the British legal system did just 50 years ago. So, there you go. A very sad and tragic life story. We'll just have to wait and see how the campaign for an official apology from the British government goes. All right, we've got an interview to play shortly, so I think that'll be enough news for today. Let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we're going to get into some serious look at what happened in Canberra on the National Marriage, at the National Marriage Breakfast, and we'll be talking to John Davey and John Kloprock on our world exclusive here on Reality Check at Joy 94.9.
Over 200 volunteers bring you joy every week. Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Joy 94.9. The show is Reality Check, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And the song you just heard there was Into the Nightlife by Cyndi Lauper. Now, as promised, our world exclusive. For the first time ever, John Davey and John Kloprogger, two LGBT rights activists living in Canberra, are going to talk together about their experience of staging a silent protest at the so-called National Marriage Breakfast, held in the Great Hall of Parliament House in Canberra on August 13th. We reported on that event last week here on Reality Check, but let me just refresh your memories on what exactly that event was. The National Marriage Breakfast was organised by a number of right-wing Christian groups, such as the Australian Family Association, the Australian Christian Lobby, and the Fatherhood Foundation. And it was organized with the purpose of celebrating the fifth anniversary of the passing of the federal ban on same-sex marriage, which of course took place on the 13th of August 2004. I mean, can you imagine just how nasty these people are? They hold a party to celebrate the denial of a basic civil right to a minority group. Really charming folk. Anyway, a few hours ago, I recorded an interview with the two Johns who protested at the event. So let's take a listen to that interview right now. Okay, I'm joined here in the studio now by John Davey. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you going, Tony?
Very well, thank you. And by John Kloprogger on the line from Canberra.
Hi, how are you going?
Good, thanks, John. Okay, the two Johns. So just so you listeners out there don't get confused, I'm going to call them John D for John Davey here with me, and John K
there in Canberra. Okay, you guys, so, well, a lot, you are heroes now to a lot of people in the LGBT community for what you did on Thursday, August the 13th at the National Marriage Breakfast. So the first question is, how did it occur to you, and then how did you actually get into the breakfast? Maybe I'll start with you, John, here, John D.
Oh, well, it's a bit of one of those funny stories. I'd only met John the day before, and he'd come to see me and was trying to organise a protest, and I said, yep, I'm happy to help you with that. And then in the middle of a conversation, I said, why don't we go to the breakfast? And he said, are you serious? And I thought, no, not really. Maybe, yes, why don't we try it? So I made a couple of telephone calls, and they had two tickets, and we went.
All right, how did you get in?
Through the front door, lined up with the rest of the homophobes.
All right, but you had to buy tickets, was it?
Yeah, we had to buy tickets. Yeah. Okay. We only got half a breakfast. Did you get a breakfast, John?
Yes, I did, yes, but I wasn't really feeling up to eating breakfast at that stage.
Yeah. Right, what time was it?
It was pretty early. The breakfast, the whole thing started at 7 or 7.30, but I was contemplating what we were about to do.
Yeah, I can imagine the butterflies in the stomach.
Yeah, they were certainly butterflies.
Okay, yeah, straight into the lion's den. Now, okay, so once you got in there, what happened? How many boring speeches did you have to sit through? What were they talking about? What was the tone, and what was the atmosphere like? Maybe John in Canberra.
Yeah, well, yes, there were quite a few boring speeches, but laced with some comments that would anger most of us. You know, they were talking about the importance of marriage, and of course that means heterosexual marriage, and the importance of, you know, family values, and simply why no other relationships are quite as good as heterosexual married relationships. So they'll you know, having a go at both same-sex couples, but also de facto couples, blended families, and all those non-traditional families. So really, it was all about putting married couples up on a pedestal and saying we're better than the rest of you.
I mean, who were the people who were talking? What, they were people from Christian groups?
Yeah, they had some representatives of Christian groups, and they had some politicians speak, obviously Senator Ursula Stevens from the ALP. They had a Senator Guy Barnett, a Tasmanian Liberal Senator.
Okay, he spoke as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had the former Governor-General Michael Jeffrey accept his Marriage Day ambassadorship. And he got up on the stage and accepted it and said that marriage should remain as between one man and one woman. So, you know, that was all pretty disappointing. There weren't any speakers up there who were willing to say that marriage should also be available for same-sex couples. That was not a line to be heard anywhere on that day.
No, well, yeah, obviously, particularly from the date that they chose to supposedly celebrate marriage, it was pretty obvious that it was all about celebrating the exclusion and repression of LGBT people. And so you guys went in there with your placards hidden under your coats or somewhere in bags, I presume.
Yep.
And you waited for Senator Ursula Stevens to get up. Can you tell us what happened next? Maybe John D here.
Well, John and I had a brief discussion about what we would do, and we'd made the decision that we weren't going to disrupt or be any disrupting to the proceedings. We thought that would be a bit disrespectful, even though it was a very disrespectful event to gay and lesbian people. So we just decided to walk up on stage and quietly stand there and announce to that collection of people that gay and lesbian people were part of the discussion on marriage.
And how did you do that? Well, tell the listeners what your placard said.
Well, John had made the placards, I think, that morning, hadn't you, John? So he was gluing them together in the front seat of my car on the way to Parliament House. And it said, inclusion equals equality. It was just a very simple message. And I had a rainbow flag to make sure that we were talking about the inclusion of the gay and lesbian community. And we just walked up on stage and stood next to each other, and he held one sign, I held the other, with the equal bits in the middle. And I had the rainbow flag. I think you had one too, didn't you, John?
I did, and then it disappeared.
Yeah, they stole it from
me. All the kerfuffle, it disappeared at some point.
Yeah.
And I mean,
maybe Senator Heffernan stole it from me.
He was certainly very interested in you.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that in a minute. But the point I want to make... Oh, the reason that you chose... I mean, I really liked the words that you chose, and maybe you should mention John Kay in Canberra, the reason that you chose inclusion.
Yeah, well, inclusion equals equality because... Senator Ursula Stevens is the Parliamentary Secretary for Social Inclusion. And so if you're going to talk about social inclusion, you have to talk about including same-sex couples in, marriage laws in Australia. But we pretty quickly worked out that as far as the Rudd Labor government goes, their idea of social inclusion is only including those, the religious right and what they want and how they would dictate marriage policy in Australia. So we thought a simple message, inclusion equals equality, would enforce the point that Senator Stevens should really think about introducing marriage equality in order to be truly representative of her role.
Yeah, no, I mean, when I heard who spoke at the breakfast, that it was the Parliamentary Secretary for Social Inclusion, I just thought, George Orwell couldn't have come up with a better script for this. You know, it's just, the irony is just smacks you there in the face. It's impressive. Okay, and so you guys stood up there, and you were there for a couple of minutes, as I understand, and then what happened? Maybe John Dee here.
Well, it felt like a bit of an eternity, and of course there was a mood shift in the room.
Yeah.
And when they realised, and I thought, you could feel from the audience, they were thinking, who are those guys? And, oh my God, they're those guys, was the sort of response. And so there was this hushed silence, and then there was this muttering and sort of, I suppose, hostility you could feel rising from the audience. Mm. And then one guy just came out of the audience and started to talk to John and I. We were sort of elevated because we were on the stage, and he was standing at the front. I was hoping it was a groupie, but I was wrong. And he just kept telling us, me in particular, to get off the stage and that we'd had our say. And John and I just stayed there. We had no intentions of moving. It felt like an eternity, but the hostility in the audience just became palpable, and it was pretty I suppose apprehensive about what would happen next. And then what happened next, which was they came up and grabbed us and took us off the stage.
Okay, well, maybe John Kay in Canberra, can we get you to follow up here? Because I understand that it was not just the Parliament security who grabbed you guys, is that right?
Yeah, it was parliamentary security that grabbed me quite forcefully by the upper arm and manhandled me off the stage. But also the organisers, I believe, actually picked on John Davey. And he can tell you a bit more about that, or what they did to him.
Right, so you, John Kay, I think you were whisked out pretty quickly out of the Great Hall, weren't you?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, okay, so maybe back to you, John Dee. What happened to you?
Well, John went one way and I went the other, and I didn't see where he went, and I was a bit concerned about that because we'd then been separated. So I was sort of wondering where John had gone and if he was okay. And this guy, who clearly wasn't security, as when I could get a good look at him, he was wearing a National Marriage Day badge. So I realised he was one of the participants, and he kept jabbing me and pushing me, I sort of dropped what I was holding, and he sort of put his hand around my neck. He called me a faggot,
And he called you a faggot.
Yeah.
Oh, charming.
Get out of here, you faggot.
charming Christian.
Pretty clear he was referring to me. Mm-hmm. And then this guy came out of the audience. This other guy just got out of his chair and came up and put his hand up at my his fist up at my face and said, "Get out of here, you filthy faggot," and pointed towards the exit. So I was actually on the other end of the hall, so they had to walk me all the way around the hall to get me back to the front door. And I just kept saying to him, "Don't touch me, get your hands off me, don't touch me." And he kept grabbing me and sort of, you know, he was very forceful, a bit of pain from the grip that he was having on my arm and on my neck and my throat. And then basically they frog marched me out of the building. And when I got out the front, John was out the front, so...
Oh, right. So you were reunited.
Rather finally, quickly.
Yeah.
And so, with Senator Heffernan.
Right. Okay. We'll get into that in a second. But I think the most interesting point here is that, okay, John Kay, you were grabbed by a security guard, which, okay, it's understandable, perhaps. But I reckon that you, John D., being grabbed by just a participant who has... I mean, he's just a person in Parliament House. He's just an individual. It seems to me that would seem like pretty strong grounds for assault and battery. I don't know if you've had any advice about that or if you can talk about that, but
I can't talk about it right now, but I have made a complaint to the police.
Right.
And that's because I'm of the view that nobody gets to touch me and rough me up without my permission.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't care where it was. It was Parliament House. And so pretty quickly out the front, we'd made a complaint to the police that were there. And then that was followed up later today. And I believe those investigations are still ongoing. I think the thing that shocked me more than anything, and I was sort of in the Great Hall a little bit longer than John, was how quickly they became violent. The animosity towards two gay people there who were just standing there, but identifying themselves as being gay and demanding rights for our community, they became very violent very quickly. And I certainly had a level of apprehension that was about, well, one guy's gotten out of his chair and grabbed me, another guy's put his fist up at my face and called me a faggot. There were 500 of them in the room and people were clapping as these guys were sort of roughing me up a bit. So I didn't know how far it would go. And by the time they'd marched me around the other side of, towards the exit, I was pretty relieved to get out of there because I just didn't want it to get any uglier than it was.
No, sure, I can imagine. Okay, so John Kay in Canberra, what do you reckon this event, and particularly the participation of Senator Stevens and the small business minister, Dr. Craig Emerson, what does this say about the Rudd government and its commitment to equality?
Well, it just demonstrates, really, that the Rudd government is not interested in equality. What they're really interested in is fostering a cozy relationship with the religious right. The symbolic endorsement that they gave to this homophobic marriage breakfast really demonstrates that they want to get into a good relationship with the religious right. And that's underlined further by the fact that Kevin Rudd has agreed to be the keynote speaker for the upcoming Australian Christian Lobby's national conference on November the 21st. I think that's a horrible thing because the Christian Lobby are notorious homophobes. They've said some horrible things about LGBTI people. And I really think that this cosy relationship between the Rudd Labor government and the religious right needs to be exposed and people need to know about it.
John D., anything to add?
Yeah, I think the Prime Minister should reconsider speaking at that conference. I think after Bill Heffernan's antics at that breakfast and the virulent homophobia that was expressed to us personally and the rest of the country on that particular day, the anti-gay marriage day, I think my call would be for the Prime Minister not to re-endorse these people and to distance himself and his government from people who are spreading prejudice, hate and fear.
Okay, John Kay, let's go back to you because I understand that once outside, Senator Bill Heffernan, Liberal Senator from New South Wales, then left the Great Hall to go and have a word with you. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, so he came out of the marriage breakfast and he wanted to have a few words with me, and he said, just come over here, mate, just come over here. And he was pointing away from the camera. There was a camera there. And he said, just come away from the camera. I just want to talk to you. And I said, well, why can't you talk in front of the camera? And he said, no, come on. Look, haven't you got the guts? Haven't you got the guts? And I said, well, haven't you got the guts to talk in front of the camera? But
yeah,
it was clear
exactly.
He wasn't going to say anything while the camera was there. And
yeah.
So, he took me aside. And he stole my marriage day badge that we were given to when we took our tickets, and he said some pretty nasty comments that were obviously showed that he saw no distinction between gay men and pedophiles.
You can say them verbatim, don't worry.
Yeah, well, it's been reported in the press,
yeah.
And it's been reported, as he was saying, I don't mind gay people as long as they stop effing the kids. It's horrible. It's just a horrible attitude to have, and it just shows the level of prejudice that some members of our own Senate hold. And he made a few other comments. He said, the anus is not for shitting. The anus is for shitting. It's not for effing. And he kept asking me if I was of the age of consent. So obviously...
obviously, he had an interest in that question for some reason.
He's just doing an integrity check, I think.
All right. Well, you touched on the point there that the worrying part here is that this is a member of the Senate. This is a legislator for the country making these, what I would call completely ignorant and bigoted comments.
Well, that's right, and he's just an embarrassment to our whole federal parliament to have someone like this to be welcomed by one of the major parties in this country. It is a real shame, and, you know, it really would say something about Malcolm Turnbull and his leadership if he's willing to put up with such bigoted people within his party,
Yep. Yeah, I mean, and especially, you know, often people say it, but, you know, if it were about race or if it were about women or maybe another what's considered minority group, there would probably be much more of an outcry.
Well, that's right. They see us as an easy target, which we're not, but they think that prejudice against gay and lesbian people is quite acceptable, and so we want to change that attitude, and so we wanted to make a statement on that day.
Excellent. That's what I wanted to round up with. Like, maybe we'll go with you, John Kay, in Canberra first, and then come back to John D. Why did you do it? What was your point? You're a troublemaker.
It wasn't that we're troublemakers. It was about. The law on marriage in this country discriminates against same-sex couples. We should not be celebrating the day that discrimination was enforced and entrenched in our law. And the government itself, through Ursula Stevens, should certainly not be endorsing an event like this, organised by the religious right, to ensure that same-sex couples remain as second-class citizens. Simple as that.
Yep.
Well said. For me, it was a really important public issue because I think gay and lesbian people have come a long way, but we still need to assert our visibility wherever and whenever. But it's also our parliament as well. And one of the police officers said to John and I after we left the building, hey, you know, you can't do that in my house. And I said, actually, it's our house as well. And I think what happened 5 years ago was that a minority extreme group in Australia hijacked our federal parliament. And my view is that we need to take that back. We need to say that all people need to be included in Australian laws, and the Marriage Act needs to be amended. It's as shameful as apartheid it was in South Africa, and we were there to make that point.
Yep, and a good point that you made too. I think that the best thing that came out of it, in fact, was that you did get a lot of publicity across the country in TV and the press and radio, and it was all bad publicity for them, bad publicity for the homophobes who organized this National Marriage Breakfast. So I say congratulations, guys. You're a hero to a lot of, you're heroes to lots of people. And I think what you did was admirable. And I think, like, particularly those words that you chose, so simple, inclusion equals equality, were so, brought the message home very simply and clearly. And I think it was a great result. And you had a lot of guts to do what you did. So congratulations.
It's very nice. Thank you.
Thanks, Tony.
No worries. Okay, John Davey here in the studio in Melbourne and John Klopperogger in Canberra. Thank you very much for coming on to Reality Check.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Tony. Bye.
So there you have it. A world exclusive here on Reality Check. The two Johns talking together about their action on August 13th. And just for your information, if you actually do a Google search of the words National Marriage Breakfast, the very first item that appears, even above the webpage for the event, is a news headline saying, "Protesters assaulted at marriage breakfast." So it's great to see a nasty event like that getting lots of negative publicity. They certainly deserve it. Now, just a quick mention, if you've been tuning in today for part three of our analysis of Dr. D'Adamo's blood type diet, I'm afraid that because of the length of our world-exclusive interview today, you'll have to wait around for another week. But next week, I promise, we will continue with our in-depth examination of Dr. D'Adamo's theories and whether anything he says actually stands up to scientific scrutiny. And finally, if you would like to send any questions, comments, or feedback to the show, please do feel free to send us an email. The address here is realitychecktony@gmail.com. That's realitychecktony, T-O-N-Y, @gmail.com. All right, let's listen to one more song, and when we come back, we'll get stuck into this week's movie review.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Hi, we're Bananarama, and you're listening to
Joy Melbourne 94.9.
Mm-mm. Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, here on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au, and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The time now is 2:07, and the song you just heard there was Dímelo by Enrique Iglesias. Okay, that brings us to the last segment of the show, which is this week's movie review. And the movie up for review today is a US documentary called The Cove, currently screening on limited release throughout Australia. The Cove deals with a dirty little secret, something horrific and shameful that occurs every year in the tiny Japanese fishing village of Taiji. From September to March every year, the local fisher people use boats to herd dolphins from the sea into a secluded little cove surrounded on three sides by steep rock walls. There, a few dolphins are selected by international buyers and flown off to become performing dolphins in theme parks or in those swim with the dolphins style attractions all around the world. The hundreds of dolphins that remain, however, are then slaughtered and their meat is sold throughout Japan. So the documentary basically follows a team of camera and sound experts as they try to set up hidden cameras and underwater sound recording devices in the cove to try to film the killing of the dolphins, all the while also trying to avoid the local police and fisher people who are desperately trying to keep cameras and photographers away from the site of the dolphin slaughter. Now, the aim of the film the aim of the filmmakers is to film the event, the killing of the dolphins, and then send these images around the world to expose what's happening in Taiji and then to create international outrage and ultimately to pressure the Japanese government into banning the capture and slaughter of dolphins. And this campaign is principally led by a man called Richard O'Barry, who's a longtime activist against keeping dolphins in captivity. Now, interestingly, he started out as one of the trainers for the dolphins who starred in that hugely successful US TV show of the 60s, Flipper. But after leaving Flipper, and particularly after the death of one of the star dolphins, he changed his mind dramatically, did a complete 180, and he no longer condones using dolphins for human entertainment, and he started campaigning to release them all back into the wild. Anyway, in this documentary, The Cove, they eventually do get all their hidden cameras installed inside artificial rocks and under the water and a lot of secret places, and they finally get to film the slaughter of the dolphins, which we do get to see in the movie. Now, The Cove is an interesting documentary, and it follows a kind of heist movie narrative where you have all the characters who come together to pull off this one big job. And there is a certain suspense in the movie about what's going to happen, and then satisfaction when they succeed in putting it all together. And I did enjoy the movie, but I also had a number of problems with it. And the main problem is that the film obviously has an agenda, which is to get audiences riled up about this slaughter of dolphins and to get them to go to the film's website after seeing the movie and then take action to put pressure on the Japanese government. Now, I agree with their agenda, and I would also like to see this dolphin hunting banned, but I didn't like the way that they go about presenting their message. I think maybe the filmmakers need to listen to this show, Reality Check, a little more often to hone their critical thinking skills, because this film has a lot of emotion but very little critical and rational analysis. They never really make a clear and rational argument as to what is actually wrong with the slaughter of dolphins. Instead, they rely just on lots of warm, fuzzy statements about how dolphins are so smart and so majestic and so intelligent and how humans and dolphins have a special bond, etc. Stuff that we've heard many times before. And so they have a lot of people talking about how much they love dolphins, and they have lots of emotional background music when these people are talking. And at one point they even have a scientist who says, he knows all about the brain and the anatomy and the breeding habits and life cycles of dolphins as a scientist, but when he swims with a dolphin and looks it in the eye, he just senses that he is communing with another intelligence. Which is fine, which is good. I mean, I don't deny the reality of his experience, but it's not a very convincing, rational argument. Number one, about why you shouldn't slaughter dolphins, and then also what's so special about dolphins as opposed to other relatively intelligent animals out there. I mean, you could easily make the same type of film or the same type of argument about rats if you wanted, or any other animal. I mean, you just put lots of emotional backing music and show images of really cute-looking rats and have a voiceover talking about how they're more intelligent than we think, and that rats are really very social animals, and they recognize and care for members of their family group, And then you cut to a woman crying as she talks about how her beloved rats were exterminated. And, you know, you get the idea. You can make pretty much any animal seem special and the killing of that animal seem tragic. But that's just emotional manipulation. That's not a rational argument. I mean, and also, if you're worried about dolphins being killed, which, fair enough, it's very cruel. But if you're worried about it, like, particularly because they're intelligent, well, you know, the Japanese just kill 23,000 of them every year. Now, that seems a lot. But, you know, think about pigs. Pigs are extremely intelligent, too. And look at the horrific ways that they're treated all over the world and then slaughtered in their millions every day all over the planet, and also in ways that are mostly shielded from the public eye in slaughterhouses owned by large corporations that never let cameras or photographers inside. So, I mean, you know, what about the pigs? What about the cows or the sheep or the goats? Why focus on the dolphins? Of course, that doesn't mean that it's not a worthwhile fight to try to stop the slaughter of dolphins. But I was left thinking about, you know, where does this obsession for dolphins come from? And also, the other thing that was slightly bothered me a little bit about this movie was that here you have a team of white American filmmakers going into this little Japanese fishing village to tell them what to do, to campaign to make them stop what they've been doing for years. So there is a certain element of the imposition of American or Western cultural values here. Okay, in the movie they do point out that most Japanese would be horrified at the slaughter of dolphins too, but still, I can understand the anger of local fisher people there. I mean, I don't agree with them, but I can understand where their anger comes from. And finally, the other thing the film does is it does go off on tangents sometimes, not making logical arguments to support their case, but just to kind of make the Japanese government look bad in general. For example, they talk quite a lot about the International Whaling Commission and Japan's hypocrisy in trying to justify its whale hunting program on the grounds of scientific research, and how Japan gives significant sums of money and other gifts to small impoverished countries to get them to vote Japan's way at the International Whaling Commission. So yes, Japan is acting disingenuously here, you could say immorally, and it's playing politics with money. But so what? The International Whaling Commission deals specifically with whales, not dolphins. So it's pretty much irrelevant as to why we should be concerned about the slaughter of dolphins in the village of Taiji. And the filmmakers also spend quite a big chunk of the movie talking about mercury levels in dolphin meat and going on about how terrible mercury poisoning is. Well, yes, it is. It's terrible. But so what? They never compare mercury levels in dolphins with mercury levels in other fish or other species high up in the food chain. They don't say the dolphins are more dangerous than other fish. So it seems like it's all of a bit of a red herring to me, if you'll pardon the pun. But having said all that, I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not supporting the slaughter of dolphins or eating dolphin meat. I am a vegetarian. I've been a vegetarian for over 20 years, and I don't condone the slaughter of any animals for food. But I just found this documentary a little bit insulting in that it uses a kind of splattergun approach to throw a lot of information at you, a lot of it pretty much irrelevant, and it also plays on that particular emotional attachment that humans have for dolphins, with lots of emotional music and lots of sweeping statements, but without very much critical analysis. For example, what are the arguments of the other side? What do the local Japanese say? And, you know, basically, if you think it's wrong to kill dolphins, then why? Put forward a strong, rational case. There are cases that you can make. I would have liked to have seen that, a more balanced approach and a more rational case in this movie. But, you know, this is The Cove is a movie worth seeing, and I did enjoy it. I just would have preferred a little bit more reasoned argument. Okay, that brings us to the end of the fourth episode of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com. And remember to tune in at 1 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 5. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.